The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good evening. Can you hear me okay? A little bit louder? A little bit louder? Okay. We also have hearing assistant devices. If you have trouble hearing, you can use them. They're on the counter in the outer hall there. So does this work okay now? Yeah? Okay. Before I give the talk, I was going to mention that that Home in the World, the sitting group that meets, said it starts at 7:30 this Sunday. I believe they're going to start at 7 this Sunday. Do something special for the holidays. Okay. This evening I'd like to talk about mindfulness of the body as a foundation for mindfulness. And I was originally trained in Buddhist meditation practice and Buddhist practice in the Zen tradition. And one of the important aspects of Zen training is that it's very body-centered. If you'd read books by D.T. Suzuki or some of the, Alan Watts or those people who wrote about Zen got in the 1950s, 1960s, you wouldn't have any clue that the body had a role in Zen practice. But Zen training has a lot to do with what happens in your body, what you do with your body. After I spent 5 months in a monastery in Japan, I didn't think it was such a good experience for me at the time. And actually, I thought of leaving early. But I stayed to the end. And once I left the monastery in the next days or weeks after leaving, I was surprised that I had been changed by the monastic experience. But I'd been changed through my body, not through my mind. I think I was looking, you know, for some kind of mind change. But in the Zen monastery, you put yourself through all these motions, and you use your body a lot, and the body becomes the way you absorb the teachings or how you change and all that. Let me give you a very simple example. In the monastery, Zen monasteries, you do a lot of bowing. And I once counted how many times I bowed from the time I woke up at 4 o'clock until, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know, I forget what I got to, but you know, 54 or something times I bowed. It's a lot of bowing. And if you pass someone on the path in the monastery, you're supposed to actually do a full stop and bow to them. There's all this bowing. And even if you don't want to bow, and you don't feel like bowing to someone, you have to bow. It's like the rules of the monastery. But if you do this, if you put your hands in front of you with hands, palms together, and well, you don't have to do it. You're welcome to do it. It's nice to see. But it was just rhetorical if you do. But if you put your hands together, then especially I like to do it in front of my heart. If you put your hands together like this, and you tip your body forward a little bit, like you do for a bow, it changes you ever so slightly. And it does, and, you know, maybe you don't notice it if, you know, the first time, but if you do it 54 times before 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, it has a very different effect than, you know, making a fist with your hand and, stop, you know, whatever, you know. It's all kinds of things you can do with your body, right? And, but what you do with your body affects your mind. And what you do with your posture affects your mind, affects your mood, it affects your attitude, it affects a lot of different things. And if you do a lot of bowing, maybe for different people it has a different effect, maybe what you associate it with. But for me it created a sense of a lot of gratitude, a lot of reverence, a lot of sense of respect. And in the best senses of the term, a kind of don't know if humility is the right word at all, but certain kind of lowering of conceit, putting conceit down. And it was so nice. I got to, you know, after 3 years in the monastery, it was so great to do this. And then I went from the monastery to living at the Zen monastery at Tassajara for 3 years. And when I left, I happened to go to Berkeley. And I was walking down College Avenue in Berkeley, and there were all these people on the street, you know. But I just wanted to bow to them. But, you know, it was kind of, it would have been kind of weird to, you know, bow to total strangers on the street. So I was feeling a little bit kind of like pent up, or like a little bit like, you know, got to get those bows out. And coincidentally, down the street, about half a block across the street, I saw a woman who had spent part of the summer at the monastery. And so I yelled at her, I called out to her and said, you know, hey, stop. And I came over to her and I bowed to her. Because that sentiment was there. And so one of the things you do with your body in the Zen monastery, a lot of the is meditate with your body. And the body is a very important part of the meditation practice. And so in Zen, if you go to a Zen monastery, and especially here in the West, and get instructions in meditation practice, I think some vipassana, like mindful, you know, people do mindfulness practice in this usual American way, or vipassana practice, they would almost not recognize it because it's so different. The first thing you're told is how you stand in outside the meditation hall, and how you step across the threshold to go into the meditation hall, and how you bow after you get across the threshold, and how you walk across the floor to get to your seat, and how you bow to your seat before you sit down, and how you sit down, and how you, in what way you sit down, and how you turn around to sit on your cushion. And how, then you're told how to sit on your cushion, and again, very, very exact instructions sometimes on exactly the posture you're supposed to take. If you're in Japan, that posture is sitting in full lotus. Here in the West, it's not so, you know, so important. In fact, in Japan, if the monks, sometimes you're wearing these black robes, and if you sit in full lotus, then what you could do with someone is you can, they're sitting like this, right? And then if you go behind them, kind of just underneath like their right butt, like there's a little space between the zafu and the, and if you take a, they have these big sticks that they hit people with in Zen. And so you take that stick and you stick it underneath here, and it'll come straight out to underneath like this. But if you are sitting like the way I sit these days, like this, right, like this, if you do that with a stick, it hits something. Ow. So they would periodically come around and make sure that the monks were sitting in full lotus. But because I was, somehow because I was, you know, I don't know, they didn't have high expectations for me, so I didn't get this, that little thing. But again, so the point being, so that, I got a little distracted, but the point being that the very particular posture, so with your legs, your hands have to be a very particular way. You know, if you see people meditate here, their hands are all over the place. Everyone has to sit the same way. The back has to be straight in a certain way. I can't tell you how many times teachers come over, Zen teachers, and straightened out my back because I was slumping, you know. A very particular thing with your chin, with your eyes, even with your tongue, they give instructions for. What you do with it, it's not tongue, in case you're wondering. And then sometimes they'll just say, and you sit there and you do that until the bell rings at the end of the meditation. What? What about mindfulness? What am I supposed to be mindful of? Sometimes they give you a little bit more instruction. They tell you to be mindful of the breathing. But a lot of the mindfulness has to do with that posture. And if you're not used to this posture, then it takes a lot of attention to keep that posture and be there. And there's a lot of kind of enforced awareness because if people are new to this, it's uncomfortable to take the Zen posture. And so you have to kind of, your attention is clearly called to your body because of the discomfort. And but the idea is also in Zen is that during the 40 minutes of meditation, you're not really supposed to move at all. And so you're sitting there completely still, and if you're uncomfortable and you can't move, it brings even more attention to your body. And so your body is like really front stage, you know, front and center of what's going on, what's your body, being in your body. And so there's a tremendous emphasis on being in your body, being connected to your body. And it brings a certain kind of presence into your body. And so when I was studying Zen, they didn't use the word mindfulness. They just said, you know, take this posture. But that posture required a lot of attentiveness. And a certain kind of strength and a certain kind of confidence. You know, as I said, you know, what you do with your body affects your mood. And if you take an upright, dignified, strong posture, it affects your, you know, chest is open, the shoulders are hanging. If you do it over and over again, it kind of affects you in some kind of way. And so what happens, what happened to me is that there was developed a very strong reference point of being grounded and centered in my body, being present in my body. A certain kind of presence or beingness in my body. That sense of just, and there was just the idea of just resting in that beingness, just being present for that. There was no instruction given on changing any of my experience, just be in the experience. And that just being in the body, often there was very little instructions of what to do with the mind, except, you know, come back to your body, be in your body. If your mind wants to be in your body, or be with your breathing as part of the body. And so what I found after a while is that there started to be, being more and more centered and present in the body, a kind of an awareness, or a kind of a sense of being, or a sense of awareness that emanated or arose out of the body. And so one of the things that started happening to me is my center of attention, of where awareness resides, was no longer in the brain. And before I did Zen, if someone said, you know, where are you aware, I would have pointed up here to my brain. And after some time of doing Zen practice, if someone asked, where is awareness, I would point to my body. It resides in my body, awareness. It's no longer in the little control tower up above. And then over time, that sense of awareness, radiant awareness that kind of seemed to emanate or arise out of the body, after a while, just seemed to emanate and arise and just be, you know, have no location. Or if there was location, I would just go like my arms is great, it's everywhere kind of feeling, big arc with both arms. And so there was a. It wasn't that I was being mindful, but rather I was. How to say this? It wasn't that I was practicing mindfulness. I was being mindfulness, being attention. I wasn't doing awareness practice. I was simply being aware. And my job was to just be in my body. And then if you relax, and as you get into it, you don't have to, as you relax and get more centered in your body and relax, that sense of awareness is naturally there. So this is why I think, because the Zen master Dogen, the founder of the particular school of Zen that I practiced, he defined mindfulness of the body as the body's mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. And a lot of people, when they think, you know, if people like me give instructions, be mindful of your body, so many people think that they're supposed to kind of do something with their attention in the control tower and look down, direct it to the body, kind of like attention is directed towards the body. But rather in Zen, the idea is that awareness arises out of the body. And to be mindful of your body is not to direct attention in the body, but rather to relax and allow that sense of presence and attention to be there. And in the Theravada tradition that we practice in here, that sense of presence and the idea of awareness arising out of the body rather than directed to the body is part of the function of samadhi practice, of concentration practice. And many people say that Zen is primarily a concentration practice. And the idea is that the more you develop samadhi, the more the awareness becomes pervasive. It pervades your body. Actually, part of the instructions for samadhi practice is to pervade awareness throughout your body, to awaken the body. And so that awareness becomes something that is being expressed rather than something you do. And so in Zen, they talk about, rather than saying that you're doing the practice, it's more like you're being practiced. And that's very different for people who are very kind of the ordinary kind of course of how to use your mind or do your practice is to be the one who is the doer. I'm going to do the practice. You know, so I have to get concentrated. I have to do this, you know, and I got to listen to the instructions so I know what to do. And what do they say? A, B, C, and, you know, it's all this kind of this whole thing you do. So you're doing the practice. In Zen, it's kind of like more like you're being done to, because you've created the conditions. You've created a temple. You've created a monastery in your body by how you sit and by relaxing and having awareness kind of be here. It's a difficult thing to learn for some people because of how much ordinarily we kind of are taking responsibility for our life and trying to do things and trying to be successful or trying to do it right or do, you know, follow instructions or just ordinary. It's very ordinary to be the one who does the doer. And it's fine to do that. It does work to do that way. Just a little different route to get into the meditation practice that way. But the Zen route is more, from the inside out. In a little bit, inside out, outside in. When I was in Nepal, my first was doing this practice of Vipassana. I was practicing with my Burmese teacher, and we were in a little monastery. There were a small room with was a bedroom for four of us American men, Western men. And one of the senior American Vipassana teachers was sitting that retreat. And so we would mostly meditate on the mattresses on the floor in this little room. There was just enough space for four mattresses. And so we were sitting, you know, we were pretty intimate, sleeping in the same room and, you know, meditating next to each other. And then we had interviews with a teacher together, some group interviews. So I got to hear the senior American teacher have his interviews with his teacher. And at some point, he started talking about his back pain. And he had a lot of back pain. He said to the teacher, "No, if I was back in America, I'd leave the retreat and go to a chiropractor because it's so intense. But I can't." And then he proceeded to explain or describe to the teacher in great detail the fine details of the experience of pain in his back. He was very mindful. He was very attentive. He had great capacity to practice. And I was so inspired by this description of pain. Wow, you could do that? You can pay that much attention to pain and really kind of just be there with it that way. And he was very equanimous about it. And he said, if I was in America, I'd go to the chiropractor. But we were meditating next to each other. And his posture, from a Zen point of view, was kind of poor. You know, he was all slouched over, bent over, you know. And if you slouch a lot when you're meditating for weeks on, I think it was 4 weeks we meditated there, you know, it puts a lot of strain on the back. And I thought, well, if he just sits up straight, if he takes, you know, it'll be a lot better for his back. So I broke one of the rules of the retreat. I went over to him one day in our little room and I said, "Psst." I whispered to him, "You know, if you sat up a little straighter, I think it might be easier for your back." And he looked at me with great care and compassion. It was just such kind eyes. And I was there as a Zen monk. And so he looked at me and he said, "Oh, from Zen, you do it from the outside in. And we do it from the inside out." the practice. And I just shrug, kind of in my mind, I just kind of shrug, oh, well, if that's, if that's what you're going to do, then, you know. And so in Zen, there's a kind of outside in, the sense of the form, you know, what you do with your body, you put your body in posture, can seem like it's outside, you know, from outside in. And in Zen, there's, in Vipassana for him, it was like from the, you pay attention to what's in there. But I think in Zen, the idea is you start with this form that you take, and then with time, something awakens within. Awareness awakens, so awareness becomes radiant, or radiant emanates or flows out. And it's not, you can't take it as being yours. It's not like a personal thing, because you're not the one who's doing it. It's just being done. So mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. And your body and your mind, your whole, all your senses, can operate without you telling them to operate, right? So you don't have to tell your eyes to see. If you have eyes that function, you can just open your eyes and they'll see, right? For most of us, we are constantly aware of our bodies as we negotiate our life and walk around. We're just not thinking about it, you know. We might be kind of not paying any attention to our bodies, but our bodies are certainly paying attention to the environment and to ourselves and our balance. You know, just try to stand up straight and not, you know, if you're standing straight for a line in the supermarket, you might be involved with a National Enquirer. But your body is paying attention to keeping you upright and balanced, you know, and not tipping over and all the little subtle adjustments. Your body is being aware. And so the body has a capacity to be aware of what's happening, be conscious or be aware or register what's going on. And so the idea is to kind of relax and allow that inner awareness that's there already to kind of operate or be known in the space of awareness, allow it to be there and come out, rather than to do it all kind of in a mental way. Zen practice can be very frustrating for many people because it's a hard thing to understand. And what I saw in some of the places, some of the monasteries I practiced in, especially in Japan, they were very poor at explaining this. And so, if you had a whole other way of operating, you couldn't quite get the idea that you're supposed to, trust the body or relax into the body or kind of allow this thing to kind of arise and flow through you. And so what Zen practice has a lot to do about is letting this inner thing express itself. It's a form of expression rather than a form of doing, rather than a form of accomplishing. And so in the Zen tradition I practiced in, the idea of having a gaining mind was taboo. You're not supposed to practice in order to gain anything, to accomplish anything. That was already diluted. And so then, what? Why am I doing it then? you're supposed to do something for no reason at all? There has to be a reason to accomplish something. And that's lovely because then you get to face and deal with all this, need for reasons and accomplishments and wanting and getting and proving and all kinds of things. But ultimately, the idea is not to be involved in gaining idea because then you're not letting the practice do you. If you're trying to gain something, you're the one who's trying to do something. So you have to want to let go of this kind of me doing something and just kind of allow this expression to come out. And so in Zen, they have kind of, ultimate great religious language for this. They say that it's your Buddha nature or you be a Buddha or you're expressing your enlightenment, or expressing realization. Practice realization is one. And so it's a little bit perplexing for some people who don't know what's being said. But the sense of allowing awareness to come out or just be there as an expression of who we are, like an artist expresses herself on the canvas or a poet writes poetry, just sometimes it's an expression that comes out. So in Zen, it's this kind of this... I call it this awareness of the awareness that resides within us operates, begins to flow and operate, and it's just there and being present. And that doesn't need anything, doesn't need to accomplish anything, doesn't need to get anything. It has nothing to do, in a sense, with the usual, you know, sense of being the agent of your life and personal agency and getting things done. So that gets more and more to the recedes more and more, but not to the background exactly, but how to say it, the sense of you being an agent who can do things remains. I found it at least remains to some, oftentimes, but it becomes. I don't know if I want to say it gets smaller and smaller, but everything else gets bigger and bigger. Or the sense of proportions change. And so the mind that is able to, a little bit is engaged in, you know, figuring out, you know, turn left, turn right here in your practice, making little adjustments in how you do, might still be operating, but it's just a kind of a small little, it's just a little adjustment, a little kind of like a encouragement, go here, go so, you know, sit up straight, lean a little bit further back, or sit up a little bit straight, or now my mind is caught up in thinking, and you know, I think maybe I should come back to my breath. Very simple, innocent thoughts like that, involve some agency, but it's a small little percentage of this big sense of presence that's just here. And it helps, that little sense of agency, but it's not—it's such a small part of the picture. Whereas sometimes when people meditate, they think that the part of agency, the part that they're supposed to pay attention and do all this stuff, that's like 99.9999% of the game for them. And when that's, then you just tie yourself in knots, because you have to trust and allow something else besides you're trying to do something in order for the deep relaxation, deep letting go, that that meditation, that, you know, deep practice is supposed to be about. So for me, my Zen training was a foundation for when I was introduced to Vipassana practice. And so I carried with me the sense of the body being the reference point, or the body being the place of stability. And so the attention, there's an attention that is, for me, is kind of second nature, to be in my body and use that as a reference point, or be there. And then from that comes kind of an awareness which is innate rather than added to it. It's not like I have to muster up and, I got to pay attention, you know. And, you know, it's more like relax and or reconnect to the awareness which is there. That's there. I benefited a lot to learn the more detailed Vipassana practice of paying very careful attention to so many different things in my life. And I found that ultimately it was more satisfying and more meaningful to do the Vipassana practice with a great care and attention, to really notice how the mind works, how the emotions work, what's going on, really going on in the body. What I saw in Zen is that like for me, for example, I just use myself as an example. I learned a lot about this kind of presence and this experience of beingness that emanates out, that felt so good. And but I had no idea of how to track that I was angry. And people sometimes would say to me, you know, Gil, you know, you seem to be angry a lot, or a lot of resentment. Because, you know, I'm like, really? Really? And because I wasn't, you know, there's a whole part of my life, parts of my life that were not open to this kind of, I wasn't told to include in this realm of tension. So like my cognitive life, the mental life, you know, I didn't pay any attention to it really, which was probably a good idea for the most part. But as I did Vipassana practice, I learned to open up and learned to really pay careful attention to a wide realm. And I learned that the tremendous value of knowing. Zen, I learned the value of being. And so the combination of being and knowing was very effective for me. And so, as I said earlier, I think that one of the ways that in our tradition now that I teach in here, that where this comparable thing has a chance to kind of surface and arise, is from a sense of concentration practice or samadhi practice. Not that you have to do kind of a different practice, but the sense of dropping in, relaxing into the body, and letting the body kind of soften and relax and open. So the awareness is not just awareness of thinking about things or just knowing things, like recognizing things cognitively, but it's really kind of being present fully, being in the experience. And that being in the experience, touching the experience with your body, is what samadhi practice is in Buddhism. And mindfulness is more than knowing. So somehow or other, to bring these two together so they're in harmony is and working together is traditionally one of the key aspects of how practice works. So your body is your temple. Your body is your monastery. And your body is something that if you learn how to be in your body, be connected to your body, will bring you tremendous benefits, tremendous, I like to use the word wealth, tremendous spiritual wealth, inner wealth. So to not leave your body off stage as you live your life, but to include, like not only include your body, you know, like paying attention to it, but be in your body. So when you, in Zen, when you do things, you're supposed to really do it with your full body. In Zen, probably a teacher, you know, wouldn't do what I'm about to do now. I wouldn't just be kind of like talking to you all and kind of picking up the glass and just kind of keep talking and saying, I have some important things to say, and let me keep telling you the important things. But rather, you know, I mean, it's a little bit stereotyped, but rather the teacher would stop. Now we can continue the talk. So you would really be there for one thing and what you're doing. And that's a training, to be with present for your body and allow that to come out. So, I hope this was okay to give this talk. But a little bit, that was my background, and I was reminded of it recently, and it was nice to be reminded. So do you have any questions about that, or comments about that, or protests? Is there a mic over on the stage there somewhere? Yeah.
Yes. Is it on? Do I sound like I'm on? Okay. I remember a friend of mine who was in the Goenka tradition, and she had tremendous knee pain for years and years and years, and she did everything that she was supposed to do, and she still had knee pain. So I guess my question is, are you just supposed to pay attention to it, just endure it?
So this is one of the things I saw in Zen, because it's being practice was so strong, and being still, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on paying careful attention like we do in our in Vipassana practice. So I knew a lot of Zen students who injured their knees and needed knee surgery because they would just endure the pain. And whereas if you pay very careful attention to the pain, I generally believe that you'll feel or see the difference between a pain signal that says danger and a pain signal that says it's okay. And you can actually feel the difference between those two. And if it's dangerous, you should move. And if you're in doubt, you should move. There are some Buddhist traditions and some schools of Zen and the Goenka tradition also, where sometimes you're told not to move. And most physical damage I know that happens to people who meditate is when they sit with pain for too long, don't listen to the danger signals, and then something gives out. So by all means, if you get any idea that it's dangerous, the pain you have, you should move. And one of the ways to know that a physical pain is dangerous, that you might injure yourself, is that if at the end of the meditation you get up, the pain persists for 5-10 minutes after you get up, then it's an injury. So, and it's not a good idea to do that again. One of the great movements in, around pain and sitting in meditation is to have a lot of pain. You know, just, oh, you can't, you know, it hurts so much. And you can't, I can't take another second. I can't take another minute. They forgot to ring the bell. Please ring the bell. You know, ring the bell. You know, I can't do it. It's impossible. You know, I'm sure the bell person fell asleep, you know. Like, please, please. And then finally the bell rings. And you say, oh, thank God they rang the bell. And then you say, oh, that was so good. And you kind of look around and, wait a minute, you know, the knee, I haven't moved, and the pain's gone. Where did it go? You know, there, a certain degree of pain has to do with the mind. And then the feedback loop of our fear and aversion and self-pity, and, you know, so sometimes a fair percentage of the pain is has a lot to do with psychology. Maybe not all of it, but, you know, magnification loop that can go on with the mind. Do we have 5-6 more minutes? Anybody else have any questions? Or yes, please. Yeah, but use the mic. People who can't hear otherwise. Is there a mic here? That here it comes behind you.
I was interested in your talking about the Zen being practice versus the more Vipassana, or not more, but just that there maybe is a little more emphasis on these different ways versus knowing. And thinking about practicing through illness, illness over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have some understanding of the being part of that because it's inescapable. But I haven't really found any way of dealing with the knowing part of it, because even the word illness has such a negative connotation to begin with. And so I would love to just hear you talk more about sort of the being and knowing with illness.
Yeah, being with illness. Well, if you sit quietly, maybe and close your eyes and relax, that'll get a little bit focused and relaxed, and let the kind of discursive mind, the usual mind, quiet down, so you don't have any conversations with yourself or with people or whatever. And then look for illness. You won't find it. You'll find pain, you'll find weakness and tiredness, you'll find particular things, but illness is an abstract idea. So if you're looking for illness, you won't find it then. But in the normal discourse of mind, we're operating kind of up here in generalizations of things. And the word illness is a generalization. So it might be interesting for you to do that exercise and see if you can find illness. And if you can't find it, how are you with your pain and tiredness or whatever you have if you don't use the word illness, if that word is not relevant anymore? Is that an interesting answer, or not?
I think that has been my experience,
okay.
Which is part of why I was saying that in that way of connecting with it through knowing, I feel that I don't have any way of connecting, and maybe I don't want to connect with it. It's very much a bodily practice of the noticing what's there, the pain, the tiredness. But I feel like in particular when you were talking about knowing and talking about sort of recognizing your emotional life and your cognitive life and sort of the insights that came from that. I haven't found a path to insight yet through... through that.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. Illness is a very, very powerful place for deeper understanding. Any time our life is limited, any time we're not things are uncomfortable and difficult and not what we want them to be, it's a time for meeting aspects of our psychology, our mind, our emotions, our reactivity. There's a whole universe of things to discover until you can be present for it all and be free, be at ease. So until you're at ease, one of the things you can start looking, investigate, and know is what is the dis-ease that you're having? Not the disease, but the dis-ease. Does that make sense? So, yeah, so what are the emotions? You know, so what are the emotions, reactions, what are the beliefs that are operating? And so, again, it helps to have the mind get quiet so that the discursive mind is not there. But still, that some of the reactivity, some of the thoughts, some of the emotions around being ill might be still operating when there's not this discursive mind. And so then you can start kind of bringing attention to look at that and see it operating. Is this kind of relevant? And so you can ask questions to yourself like, you know, what am I believing right now? Or what's the attitude that I have right now towards whatever is happening? And that might kind of start revealing some of the details. And then when you go to a doctor, you say, I have an illness. I saw someone before back there. Elaine, did you have a question?
Oh, I just had a really simple question. So I tried Zen when I was in my probably late teens, and it was very confusing because I didn't receive any instruction at all.
Right.
Except I saw the guy with a paddle. And it seemed very strict, and everyone was very careful. They were moving in very mindfully and with great awareness and very slowly. And so, you know, I tried my best to imitate them without really understanding. I mean, I was really just imitating the right. The behaviors. And I remember hearing a couple people being hit with the paddle. And I was always really curious.
If it's done right, it feels good. If it's done right.
So I actually thought, well, I remember thinking, gee, you know, this could feel really good because I was so stiff, like trying to be completely upright. And so I was just kind of wondering, when do they hit people with those paddles?
Well, they're not exactly paddles. I think of paddles being kind of wide. They're more like look like swords. They're about an inch wide. They're about an inch wide and about 3 feet or so, 4 feet long, and they get a little bit longer as they go out. You know, kind of narrow as you hold them. And the idea is that you kind of snap it. Right between the shoulder blade and the spine, or just above the shoulder blade, kind of on the muscle or the big tendons that go back here. And it depends where you, and when you do it, you have some choice about exactly where, not exactly, but some choice in the range. So if you lean over really far, then they'll do it just on the side of the spine. If you don't lean hardly over at all when they come, then they do it across the top. So if you're really stiff in the top, you know, up on top here, of your shoulder, then you don't want to bend over very far. And it's like, you know, they snap it. So it's not like, you know, and so by the time that, I don't think they do it at some of the American Zen centers anymore. They kind of stopped doing it. But for a long time, they only would do it if people requested it. And you would go like this in the meditation hall, and someone would come over, and you either requested it because you were sleepy, and it kind of, or you requested it because you were kind of tense, or you know, and just kind of loosened things up. And so it's not as cruel as it sounds, you know. But it is, you know, pretty. If you don't, you know. Anyway, I think you were a teenager a few years ago. So It's also back in those days, there was, I think in the American Zen, there was, was in America?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a little bit more of the warrior macho spirit back in those times than I think there is now. And so I think there's much more care and compassion and
yeah, I've never been back to a Zen center after that, but maybe I should try it again. Yeah.
Yes.
You should try it again. It's a lot of fun. I just got hit recently.
They hit you?
Yeah, I was in Japan.
Oh, Japan.
It was
yeah.
quite an experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It does
yeah.
wake you up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's sometimes in Japan it's a little bit more macho or something, and sometimes they, you know, then sometimes really would hurt and. And sometimes they would actually break the stick across your shoulders. It
was, yes,
it was a little much. And in the Rinzai monasteries, the Soto Zen, they hit you once on each side of the shoulder, whap whap. In the Rinzai, they would go each side. They'd go.
I'll skip that. I'll go to Soto. But my question was more around, like, I've practiced more Vipassana than Zen,
yeah.
But in Zen I've heard more this concept of sudden enlightenment, or I don't know what that means, but on the Vipassana side it seems it's more progressive purification of the
yes.
mind, and
yes.
it's more sequential, I guess. So I'm wondering, like, does even Zen have any concept of gradual purification, it's just a different way of getting to it, or they just don't care?
Yeah, Zen has everything. I mean, one of the places where you see the gradual ideas in the 10 oxherding pictures. It's a training, progressive training that goes on. But the emphasis in Zen is much more, it's sometimes the sudden. But that's a whole thing, and that's a whole talk in itself, the sudden and gradual in Zen. And it was a little bit, back when the whole sudden and gradual thing arose in Zen, it was partly political and partly had to do with, you know, rivalry between different groups in China. And so, you know, my Zen teacher, when I was practicing with him, he took it a little bit basically that both are true. It was gradual. And so one idea people say is that for everyone who practices, it's gradual until it's sudden. Because, you know, generally, for most people, the experience of something like realization, enlightenment, awakening is a sudden thing. But, you know, there's, you know, it usually doesn't happen just suddenly out of the blue. And most Zen, you know, there's a lot of training in Zen, and so they might not talk about how the training and how gradually people change, but in Zen monasteries, the teachers are watching people and they see how people mature and they see how slowly they mature, and they're guiding people's maturity over time, The idea of realization being sudden is pretty common in Buddhism, all, you know, from the earliest time. But what you give emphasis to is the thing. And so I think we're late now. Probably it's late. You guys should go to bed. You know, sleep is really good. You know, getting enough sleep is probably at least as important as getting enough meditation. So thank you all.